This is a production of Cornell University.
Back in the 70s, I had a pet bird in the house. It was a Swainson's thrush, and it went by the name of Fogel. As a chemical ecologist, I was interested in a simple question. What does the bird like and what doesn't it like? And I was referring to insects and its diet. Fogel was a finicky gourmet. If you gave him insects, he hated some, he loved others, and you could tell by the way he treated them whether they were palatable or not palatable. And what I was after was new compounds in nature. That's what drives my research. And I thought we would be able to get clues to the nature of substances in insects that are deterrent, defensive for the insect, and are the basis of rejection of the insect by the bird. So the kids were still in the house, and I would leave early in the morning with vials in a pouch and collect some 2 dozen insects, put them in individual vials, and come back for breakfast. The bird's breakfast included, the kids would sit there and watch as I fed the bird one insect after the other. And the bird handled them 3 different ways. When he liked the insect, it would grab it in the bill, orient it, swallow it, gulp down. When it was of intermediate palatability, it would grab the insect, malaxate it, that is, sort of move it in the bill, drop it, think about it, take it again, drop it. If it was hungry at the beginning of the session, it would eat it. But then there was a category of insect which the kids called the pits. The bird would peck the insect, and on first pecking would reject it and not make any second attempt. Moreover, it would remember the experience. If I gave it that same insect 2 weeks later without giving it a single time in the intervening period, the bird manifested having learned from the experience and remembered the insect very closely. So in the course of the summer, I fed about 500 items to the bird, some 100 different species, and cataloged these by the palatability. There were so many who were yum-yum. There were so many who were so-so. And there were 5 that were the pits. They were all beetles. Some of them had been studied chemically, and we knew what the chemicals were in the beetles that made them distasteful. But among the insects that were rejected were fireflies. Fireflies had never been studied chemically. So I decided we'd look at fireflies. There's an ulterior motive to the search for compounds in nature, because we found, we knew from experience, that compounds which in nature function in one context can have unusual applicability in humans. So we were working on the problem for just the basics of it. We wanted to know what a bird likes. And we also worked on it because we thought we might come up with compounds that might be useful. Well, fireflies had never been studied chemically, except for the chemistry of the light organ. So I called my research partner of many years. I mentioned him in the last lecture. This is a picture of some 30 years ago. Jerry Meinwald, professor in chemistry. And I said, do you want to work on fireflies? Fireflies are distasteful to birds, and there must be some chemical reason for it. He said, sure, get me enough fireflies and I'll work on it. So we took up market economics, took out an ad in the Ithaca Journal, and ended up with a lot of fireflies. If you pay 5 cents for a firefly, the parents go out and collect. And they use incredible techniques. They tie blankets together, they walk down a meadow and get the fireflies all trapped up in the blanket. So we went down to a penny. Kids were willing to work for that. And we had kids by the dozen come in with jars of fireflies. Jerry put 2 graduate students onto the problem. This is some years ago. The fellow on the right is now a professor in Iowa. The lady on the left, I believe, is a practicing physician. And they extracted fireflies and worked on the compounds that were responsible for their distastefulness to birds. How do you home in on chemistry, on compounds in a complex mixture such as a whole ground-up firefly? Well, you use different solvents to extract the mixture, solvents that extract different fractions of the chemicals. then you take the fractions, evaporate the solvent, and apply these to some item that the bird likes a lot, like mealworms. And you look for fractions that, when applied to mealworms, make mealworms distasteful. And this took time, but we were lucky, because you sometimes find that activity is contingent upon two compounds operating together. And when you fractionate the firefly, you lose the activity because the compounds go into different fractions. That didn't happen with the fireflies. Activity was very correlated with a number of characteristics, and the compounds went into just one fraction of the extracts. And in due course, Jerry and his folks came up with the answer. The compounds involved were a mixture of steroids. You can see this is the typical steroid configuration here. And they were new steroids, steroids that are different enough chemically you could really call them new compounds. Steroids are interesting. Steroids have hormonal actions, they have medicinal functions. Only a few steroids that I mentioned to you, you'll know what I'm talking about, testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, cholesterol. These are all steroids. So it's a hard drug called digitalis, which is obtained from plants. And we were intrigued by the fact that the firefly steroids that we got out resembled some of the steroids that we used medicinally. So we thought we'd send some of the compounds to a pharmaceutical company to tell us whether they have cardiotonic activity, which is what we suspected by the similarity to drugs. In the meantime, I worked biologically on the fireflies, and that took us into interesting territory, which I just mentioned parenthetically. We looked at different fireflies and the expectation that they might produce different versions of these steroids, but not so. Some fireflies did not produce any of these steroids. But when you analyze the female of these species late in the season, you found that they had these steroids. And we found that these females, which don't have the steroids themselves, get them by luring the fireflies that produce them, luring them by faking their communication code and lights, and then eating these fireflies with the steroids, incorporate the steroids into their own body and are protected as a result, which turned out to be a lot of fun and good science. We published that. In the meantime, we got answers from a pharmaceutical company to whom we had sent the samples. And it was disappointing. They had cardiotonic activity in these compounds, but they were not any better than the compounds on the market. They had the same side effects, basically. There's often nausea associated with taking these cardiac drugs. So the theme we thought we might hit and get some publicity for, drugs from bugs, there was a nice ring to it, failed. But we should have been more careful in who we sent the drug to. We sent it to a company that had specialty in heart drugs, but we should have sent it to other companies as well. Because other folk took these compounds, which we had called leucibufergens, they were new steroids, and the term leucibufergens implies Lucifer, the bearer of light, and bufo implies toads. It turns out these compounds were similar to some steroids produced by toads in Asia, so we combined the terms and called them leucibufergens. Well, these other investigators sent them to other companies, and it turned out that the leucibufergens have antiviral activity. And patents were taken out. This is from a patent. I don't know what status this work is in right now, but at least some years ago, there was a basis for looking for the antiviral activity of these compounds from fireflies. I don't know if you're aware of the fact that some 40% of medical prescriptions taken out in the United States annually are for compounds that have their root in nature, or that are synthesized in imitation of natural compounds, or with deliberate variation, but fundamentally of natural origin. We're dependent on nature in countless ways. But what I'd like to emphasize today is the medicinal dependence we have on nature, on the compounds of nature. I'll give you some examples. This is what kind of plant? It's a foxglove. Foxglove are the sources of certain steroids, including digitalis, one of the most familiar of all heart drugs. I'm sure many of you have, or some of you have, a grandparent who is dependent on the cardiotonic effect of digitoxin, digitalis. This is the plant from which digitalis are obtained. And here are the steroids. You recognize its similarity with the leucibufagins. Here are the steroids that are obtained from this plant. We've depended on these plants since the 18th century, the mid-1700s already. People knew that if you make an infusion from foxglove plants, you get a mixture that fights dropsy, which was swelling of your ankles and of the parts of the body from malfunction of the heart, cardiac insufficiency. Later on, the compound's been identified. But it is still obtained commercially largely from plants, from foxgloves. This is when you don't treat the patient right, what he sees. I take it I don't have a slide in there. Let me go backwards, maybe I'll get it. There we go. This is from a tree called the cinchona tree, which grows in the Andes, and which has been known for years to provide an infusion, if you take the bark, that combats a disease that is transmitted by mosquitoes, that is caused by protozoa, which get into the blood, red blood cells, and in synchrony break these blood cells up in a massive phenomenon that results in a rise of fever, a disease that is characterized by seizures of fever at fixed day intervals, and is transmitted by mosquitoes. What is it? Malaria. And the cinchona tree is a source of quinine, which is still used in the treatment of malaria when some of the synthetic drugs turn out not to be no longer useful because there's resistance to that develops in the protozoa or in the mosquito that you're trying to control. I'll give one more example. Even aspirin derives its origin from nature. It was known that if you make an infusion from the bark of certain willow trees, you get an analgesic, a painkiller, which is based on a compound called salicin. Salix is the genus of the plant. Salicin was named after that. Salicin, if you subject it to two simple chemical steps, you get a compound called acetyl salicylic acid, which is aspirin, which was brought to market some 100 years ago, a little over 100 years ago, by a company called Bayer, which thrives to this day. Bayer was one of the first pharmaceutical companies founded, first companies devoted entirely to the manufacture of medicinal drugs. Pharmaceutical industry is a recent advent. It's a little over 100 years old. And you know the importance of it. Then in 1926, a remarkable break took place. A man called Alexander Fleming, shown here, had a petri dish in which the following phenomenon played itself out. He knew he was onto something good, because he took the time to photograph the very dish in which he noticed the phenomenon. There were fungi growing. There was a petri dish with nutrient. He had left it standing open in his sink. I think I got the facts straight on that. And he noticed there was a fungal growth at one part of the dish, and a lot of bacterial growth. But the bacterial colonies in the immediate vicinity of the fungus were not growing. That is how it was discovered that you got chemical warfare between microbes, in this case between a fungus and bacteria. And he knew that he might be onto something useful. For years he tried to get industry interested in the nature of the presumed nature of the nature of the chemical that was emanated by the fungus, and staking out territory for the fungus by killing competing bacteria. Industry was not particularly interested. They had other drugs on the plate. Sulfur drugs were used widely for infectious diseases. It took World War II to put penicillin on the high priority list. In fact, I was told that isolation of high-strain penicillin, which is the drugs eventually isolated from these mushrooms, from these fungi, took priority over everything except the Manhattan Project, the development of the atomic bomb. Fleming opened her eyes, and here's one form of penicillin, complicated chemical. What Fleming did is open the eyes of the world to the possibility that microbes may be major sources of drugs. And that certainly turned out to be true. By following up on the chemistry of moles, we discovered penicillin, streptomycin, oreomycin, a whole litany of microbial products of enormous use in human disease. Just look at this figure. If you take infant mortality, the number of children dying in the first year of their life, the number per 10,000 births, you can see that in the period before penicillin or before antibiotics, as compared to a period where antibiotics were already in widespread use, was a cutting of more than in half of the infant mortality. Our dependence on antibiotics is our dependence on miracle drugs. There's no other way to put it. So there's gold in those organisms that surround us. Just so you don't think that microbes are known only to produce antibiotics, I show you this compound, which was isolated by Merck, American company, big pharmaceutical company, from a Japanese mold, which was sent in for testing, and which is a worm killer. It's $1 billion a year drug for Merck. It's used to combat infections in cattle. It's used to combat infections in dogs. The retired school teacher who moves to Florida with his Fido, the dog, no longer has to fear that the dog will die within months of heartworm, because you give the dog pellets of ivermectin and it fights the worms. But more interesting is it also fights worms in humans. There's a horrible disease called river blindness in equatorial Africa. It's caused by a worm that is transmitted by a fly. I'll be back. The worm gets into the circulation and gets into the eyes and damages the eyes, with the result that adults, by the time they're 30 years old or so, have a 30% chance of being blind. Children grow up as seeing eye kids, helping adults to move from place to place, knowing full well that they themselves are likely to fall victim to this disease at one chance in three by the time they grow up. Well, it's to Merck's credit that they make this drug available for human use throughout the world at no cost. a worm killer. I'll show you one more formula now. To look at this molecule, you know why organic chemistry is called chicken wire chemistry. This is a remarkable molecule from a Norwegian mold, cyclosporin. Cyclosporin is an immune suppressor. What can you use an immune suppressor for? Well, if you receive an organ by transplant from a donor who's not an exact genetic replica of yourself, you may reject the implant by your own immune mechanism. So if you implant a heart nowadays, you often treat with cyclosporin to maintain the immune system of the host at a low level. There's not rejection of the implanted organ. This is also a billion-dollar drug for a Swiss company. And the action is not all with microorganisms. Macroorganisms still yield interesting compounds. This is a Pacific yew tree, known as a trash tree to the lumber industry, because it's not useful as wood. They used to just chop it down together with their harvesting practices. But it turns out to be, this is the Pacific yew tree, and it turns out to be the source of a compound called Taxol, which for women with ovarian cancer may be the chemical of last resort. It's an extraordinarily potent drug, complicated molecule. If you're a chemist, you look at a molecule like this and you can estimate how many PhDs there are in it, the synthesis. The interesting ecological problems associated with this tree. It's been harvested so ruthlessly that there are only thousands of trees left in the United States. There are more in Canada. But now Taxol is being manufactured. I'm not quite up to date on that, but they're no longer dependent entirely on Taxol from wilderness. But if we were, you would literally exhaust the Taxol in a matter of years and use up all the trees. I think you need for the treatment of one woman with ovarian cancer more Taxol than you can get out of a single tree. So going at the synthesis of these compounds so that you become independent from the natural resource is an important factor. And favorite example for me is a compound called epibatidine. Simple molecule with analgesic potency, several times that of morphine, a painkiller several times more effective than morphine. I think there are many side effects still in this molecule, so it's not in wide use. And I don't really know what the status is of the chemical work on it, but I would imagine that people are trying to modify it so that it retains its pain-killing capacity, but modifying in such a way that some of the side effects are cut out. It's a vast industry, the generation of drugs from nature. So this is just by way of some examples. This is the source of epibatidine, a little frog from Central America who doesn't have the slightest idea that he's so useful. Well, when somebody like myself, a chemical ecologist, with an interest in the chemistry of nature and with a more than tangential interest in the uses that these compounds can be put to, when I see the rainforest, or I see inland waters, or I see coral reefs, I see, quite aside from the beauty, which is what drives me to these areas, I see compounds, new compounds, drugs, compounds which quite simply take on value. They're the hidden secrets. They contain hidden secrets that are useful for medicinal purposes. The question that inevitably arises is how well has nature been screened? Do we know all there is to be known about the medicinals from nature? Well, the question is really unanswerable. We don't even know. We don't even know how many species we've got on planet Earth. This chart, which is already several years old, shows 1.3 million species identified. It's probably closer to 1.5 or 1.6 now, but less than 2 million species. I'm happy to say that insects are a big fraction of the insects, of the species that are identified. Here are protozoa, here are higher plants, algae, fungi, viruses, miscellaneous vertebrates. So we don't know how many species there are. If we were all systematists here, sitting at an international tribunal of systematists, and we would take sides on guessing how many species there are on the planet, you would find some that might not go higher than 3 million, but you might find some that go as high as 100 million. I don't know how many there are, but I know that a question, how well has nature been extracted to check on my natural products, is a question we can't answer, except by saying that most natural products doubtless remain yet to be discovered. So nature is a vast unknown. What is happening to nature, I don't have to remind you of. It's being chopped down. It's eroding away where the ground cover has been removed, or it's being converted to urban areas. That drives you to another conclusion. Species are disappearing faster than we can study them chemically. Well, what are we going to do about that? The answer is we should do two things. It's as simple as that. We should intensify chemical prospecting, increase the rate at which we screen nature for components of use, and we intensify conservation so that the species don't disappear before we have a chance to look at them. But it occurred to me some time ago that in a very simplistic way, we could link these two imperatives. The increased rate of chemical prospecting and the intensification of conservation. We have to prevent the destruction of tropical forests, while at the same time we intensify the search of compounds that might be associated with these tropical forests. Tropical forests are being chopped down because the countries that have these forests are in need of revenue to survive. Well, it seemed to me that one should be able to foment partnerships between the tropical country, a developing country, which can inventory its natural resources, and a pharmaceutical company from the developed countries, which can, in exchange for the right to access the wilderness, the tropical wilderness, provide a guarantee of return of royalties from the profits derived from the discoveries made in that country, in their domain. So in 1990, I think it was, there we go. In 1990, we brought together representatives of Costa Rica and representatives of an American pharmaceutical company right here in Ithaca. It's a small meeting. We just wanted to investigate the possibility of establishing that feedback link that I showed you in that slide in a practical way. Why did we pick Costa Rica? Well, Costa Rica is an amazing country. By the way, the president of Costa Rica is one of the most remarkable presidents of any nation. Costa Rica abolished the army so they don't squander money on military purposes. They have a land use plan. About 25% of their wilderness is declared protected. They like the United States. Their budget, by the way, is not much bigger than Cornell's budget, annual budget. It gives you an idea of what we're talking about when we talk about national wealth. But one of their most useful possessions is this wilderness, this array of species with potential chemicals in them. So we brought representatives of Costa Rica to Ithaca. Costa Rica had already for some years working with their National Institute, Instituto Nacional de Biodiversidad, which was an institute that they founded for the purpose of inventorying their wilderness before establishing any kind of cooperative agreement with industry. The Instituto Nacional does many of the things that museums do. It collects and keeps an inventory of the plants, just as like you work on the insects and on other organisms. And by knowing what they've got, the value of their natural resource goes up enormously. Because an industry that works in cooperation with a country that has indexed resources can reliably tap a same sample on a subsequent effort to collect of those specimens. There's order in the museum that they generate for cataloging their wilderness. And this is very tempting for an industry. So we also invited a representative of Merck. We picked Merck because Merck, I thought, with its policy of making ivermectin free of charge, was a company with interesting points of view. It's an ancient company. This is not one of the contemporary cars. This is proof that they're ancient. And they came, we met in the morning. By noon, it was clear that a working agreement could be created. We had dinner in a restaurant which is no longer in existence. And I wish I kept a napkin because some of the people at the table wrote the gross tenets of the agreement before the end of the day. The agreement that was generated was exactly as that feedback loop that I showed before, except there was interesting specification on how the wealth was going to be shared. If you find a compound in a plant, or if you find that a plant has certain activities, let's say that it is an anti-cancer drug, it takes sometimes as many as 10 years before you've got the compound in hand and ready to be marketed. 10 years is a long time for a country with a low budget. So Merck, for the mere right of exploring the biodiversity in Costa Rica, paid $1 million up front, and then guaranteed 50% of royalties of any discoveries coming from Costa Rica wilderness. This agreement remained active for some 10 years. In the meantime, other agreements like these came into being. In Washington, an organization called the International Cooperative Biodiversity Groups, ICBG, was put together under auspices of the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation. The Department of Agriculture was involved there, also the Agency for International Development. And the purpose was to bring industries together with custodians of wilderness. So there were at one time agreements in existence between Cameroon, Nigeria, Suriname, Costa Rica, Mexico, Peru, Argentina, and Chile, and various pharmaceutical companies. The ICBG program is still in existence. INBIO is continuing to inventory the resources. India now has agreements with Korea. In other words, the idea of working jointly, developed and undeveloped country, for the common purpose and for an equitable sharing of the profits, is a model that is functioning right now. Let me turn the slides off for a second. And there's room for expansion of these agreements. And they don't have to restrict themselves to the discovery of new compounds. Tropical forests are going to be saved by developing countries if they can make more money leaving them be than if they chop them down. The motto is nature, use it or lose it. But the benefits to preserving nature are now increasing on many fronts. Take that feedback loop and instead of chemical prospecting, insert photosynthesis. Costa Rica could put its green forests to the production of ecosystem services. They could make a forest available for a charge to mop up the CO2 from the atmosphere. So the value of nature is going up exponentially now that we're finally agreeing that the world is in deep trouble from the loss of species and diversity, biodiversity. So you can justify the survival of a forest in Costa Rica, of maintaining the forest undisturbed, because you can revenue money, such as money that could be accrued from a carbon tax, which is not in existence yet, but is coming. Well, if you generate so much CO2 from making such a major carbon imprint on the planet, you owe it to a country that doesn't do that, but maintains its greenery, hungry for CO2, and therefore mopping up after the industrial pollutants. You add that to the search for medicinals. In the modern context of nanotechnological applications, where biomimicry is very often the driving force, where industry looks to nature for mechanisms, chemicals, anything that is imitable and potentially useful. It's acknowledging that nature has natural rights, that they are the custodians of vast technologically applicable ideas which are useful to the world as a whole. So there's an opportunity here for a distribution of wealth which is more equitable, is environmentally sound, and is a win-win situation all around. Let me end by just telling you about a single species with which I worked for a while, in which in a meeting that I held with Newt Gingrich, a group of us, at a time where he was trying to save the Endangered Species Act. I had a meeting with him, not alone, there were others in the meeting, Ed Wilson, Stephen Jay Gould, and we were making a plug for getting the reenactment of the Endangered Species Act, which was being threatened in Congress. And I gave this flower to Newt Gingrich to make my point of what is involved with the cost of losing a species. That species is a member of the mint family. It's very pretty. It looks like an orchid, but it isn't. It's petite. It's about a centimeter in size. And it's very unspectacular. It grows in an area in central Florida, which is usually reduced to golf courses and orange groves, called the Florida Scrub. Marvelous area. It's biologically so interesting and so unknown. Well, we played with this flower. I was interested in this plant because it was the only plant that I could spot literally from 20 feet downwind from its odor. And the odor is associated with little capsules that are present in the leaves, throughout the leaves. That's how they individually look. And they're hollow. They're filled with an oil. They get punctured when a caterpillar bites into the leaf of the mint plant. Gets a mouthful of this grenade fluid. You could demonstrate the repellency to insects of this fluid by baiting ants to come to a droplet of sugar solution, and they line up like an army contingent with great discipline, one side by side around there. If you approach them with a leaf of Dicerandra that you cut so as to cause some of the grenades, some of these capsules to explode, you can see what it does to the insects. It immediately dispels them. Insect repellents can have their uses. And this plant turned out to have not a drastically different compound, but a new natural product, transpurigol, responsible for protecting it against insects. And it was enormously potent, this oil, in insect repellency. So we thought it was interesting. We had this plant, and we got interested enough in the plant that we looked up its history. It was only described in 1926. I think that they've got the date right. It's already on the endangered species list. It is the source of a new insect repellent, but it's a source of many other things as well. I had an interesting young mycologist with me in Florida, and he took a look at this Dicerandra plant in more detail, and he found that it is loaded with endosymbiotic fungi. What are endosymbiotic fungi? They're fungi that grow inside of plants and fulfill some of the needs of that plant. A plant, when it feels sick, can't run to the drugstore. So if it can keep an in-house pharmacy consisting of microbes that produce the compounds that it needs for survival, it's obviously on a good evolutionarily secure route. Well, it turns out, I think there were some 20 endosymbiotic fungi growing inside of this plant, including one shown here with powerful antifungal activity. This is a mold growing in culture. Here is the extract of the leaf of Dicerandra. Here's the zone of inhibition showing where fungi are prevented from growing. It's the same thing as the penicillin petri dish. We have no idea what the compounds are there. But that plant is restricted to acreage less than the hole, the size of the hole that I made with a toothpick that I used to insert the flag. And those acres are all on a biological preserve. The species would doubtless have vanished to the replacement of golf courses and orange groves were it not for the fact that a biological preserve saw its survival. This plant illustrates the problem that we got worldwide on vanishing nature and the need to preserve it. It was very disappointing for me to hear practically nothing about conservation in the presidential debates of this fall. Conservation has to move to frontline dialogue in the public discourse. I'll just read you a quotation by someone called Al Gore, if I can find him, when he was Senator Gore. In other words, in 1992, in an essay espoused, Senator Al Gore, in an essay espousing the sustainable use of biodiversity, pointed to the special merits of the INBIOMERIC agreement. President Clinton himself endorsed the tenets of the agreement when he said in a speech delivered on Earth Day 1992 prior to his inauguration that, quote, "We should explore establishing the international equivalent of the Nature Conservancy, a fund contributed to by developed nations, and the pharmaceutical companies to purchase easements in the rainforest for medical research. The easements and the profits from new drugs could make not developing forests more profitable than tearing them down." So it's a simple blueprint. It's a simple way of thinking of resources being shared for the common cause of conservation. As you remain in Cornell for the rest of your graduate education and you see the university struggling to institute some sort of sustainable form of existence, keep in mind the broader picture. The problems are now global. The solutions have to be global. The politics has to adjust itself to the common need. And the rest is hard work for you and investment of a good chunk of your time. That's all I have to say. Thank you.